I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Now, I don't know about how long ago. I don't know, about a week or 10 days ago when the coronavirus stuff started, I went looking for somebody that I'd worked with when I had been elected to the city council in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and he was the director of public health, Don Shields, who's an Air Force veteran, but I couldn't find him. And then I looked on his Facebook page, and it's because he's world traveling. And he's come home, though, and I tracked him down, and he joins us today. So, Don, first of all, welcome to All Marine Radio. Thanks for doing this.
Well, good. It's good to be here, and good to talk to you again, Mike.
All right. Well, first of all, we got to find out about you. So we're going to do this like you and I have never met. So, Don, born and raised where?
You know, I was born and raised. My dad was in the military, so we traveled around a lot. My dad was an air traffic controller. But I graduated from high school in Grand Forks, North Dakota, married a farm gal from Central North Dakota, so I call Grand Forks my home. I was in the Air Force for 20 years, as you mentioned. I retired in 1994 from the Air Force, never really retired, just moved over, took a job with the city of Grand Forks as the director of their city-county health department for 20 years, and stepped down from that in 2015, but enjoyed my time in the military. During the time with the health department, we went through the flood of 1997, where we had to evacuate 50,000 people out of the town. Went through SARS in 2003 and swine flu in 2009 and 10. Got a lot of fondness for the military and a lot of military friends we still see, and that's why we travel a lot. We catch up with those military friends and love traveling in the military, and still love doing that.
The I normally ask people how did the military get on your radar, but obviously with the dad serving in the Air Force, I don't need to ask you that. What give me a couple highlights of your time on active duty with the Air Force, Don?
You know, I started out initially toward the end of the Vietnam War, and I was going to be a hospital administrator, but the Air Force said, "Hey, the needs of the military come first, and we're winding down. We don't need hospital administrators. What we need are missile launch officers." So I found myself for 4 years as a missile launch officer in the line of the Air Force, and it was really good to see that side of the house. And then I got a chance to move over to the medics and see them for 16 years. But, you know, traveling around, I was able to do a fellowship at Kaiser Permanente in Oakland, California. Traveled from San Antonio, Texas to Dayton, Ohio to southern Italy. Deployed in Desert Storm, working with an air medical staging facility for wounded vets as they came out of the Middle East, and met a lot of great people that I still stay in contact with, and just loved my experience.
You went to Saudi Arabia for Desert Storm?
Actually, the air medical staging facility we set up was in Madrid, Spain.
Whoa.
It was about a five-and-a-half-hour flight out of the Middle East. And what we did was we took wounded vets there, and we decided, can we deal with those at the burn center downtown Madrid? Do we send them up to large medical centers, Army-run, U.S.-run, Navy-run, in Germany or England or elsewhere? Or can we get them across the pond to VA and U.S. facilities in the United States, and depended upon their condition and what they needed and if they were able to do that. So that was kind of what we did. We were kind of set up to do about 450 casualties a day, and it turned over like 450 at a time, and it turned over three times a day. Luckily, we didn't have that many casualties, but I did that for about 3.5 months while I was stationed in Italy. They just kind of grabbed you and said, we need you just to set this up and go at it. So we were in Spain at the time, but it was a pretty unique, sobering experience, you know.
You bet. The reason I wanted to have you on was to explain some stuff to us. But before I start asking questions, is there stuff that you think that people that ought to be part of the conversation that really isn't part of the conversation? Let me give you the floor. Are there things that you think people should know that you don't think they know right now and aren't really being discussed?
Well, you know, I think there's several things. I think basically all of us, when it doesn't matter what type of thing we get into, whether it's a wartime, in my mind, whether it's a wartime situation or a disease entity, people want to know, how can I be safe? I think that's the bottom line. How can I be safe? How can I make myself and my family safe? And I think we do that with knowledge. We do that by empowering people. We do that by increasing trust. And with that knowledge, we lower anxiety. So if we take a look at just some general statistics about, like, diseases as they spread and pandemics. A pandemic, of course, is something that travels around the world, a disease entity that we have not seen before and our bodies don't know how to react to it. There have been 10 of those in the last 300 years, so this isn't the first time we've gone through that. A pandemic, as we see it here today with the coronavirus, it can go on for 18 to 24 months. That's kind of what we've seen in the last 300 years. It can come in two or three waves of illnesses, and those illnesses could be 2 to 3 months at a time. You have a first initial peak, a high rate. Then you have it lower, and then the third one is lower. And so what you do is, how can I break that? You know it's coming. How do I break that cycle? And so as we talk to folks, you know, you hear people go, you know, isolate, stay at home, wash your hands, let's break the cycle. You can break the cycle with a number of things. Those are things that have worked through the ages. You can break the cycle with a vaccine. You know, swine flu, we're able to develop fast-track a vaccine. That disease sprung up in February. We're able to fast-track a vaccine, so by October, we were given that vaccine to medical people and people of high risk being people who were pregnant, people who had other immune-compromised situations. But October, November, we did that. December, January, we opened it up to the public. So we never saw the third wave of that disease coming through America. So you can break that cycle, but it takes a lot of work and a lot of cooperation, and it's not always obvious. What I mean by that is that if you're on a fire truck and you run into a fire, you see that fire, you put water on, you put it out. Oh, well, I can see that. You know, if you're a policeman, you know, you can go after that car, after that robber, and you can handcuff and put it out. In public health, unfortunately, you don't see that. This data we look at with numbers of cases, numbers of deaths, you know, that lags by probably 2 weeks. So you get kind of a false sense of security around you when you should be doing things now. And it's hard to convince people that it's on fire when they can't see it. I don't know if that helps. And I'll stop talking.
No, well, no. I mean, it helps because most of us stay in our homes, right? You know, I do this from my home, so I'm not greatly impacted. But if you do go to work, you're now working from home. Unless it touches your family directly, you know, we see the evidence of it, right, by numbers and graph curves on our television. And until it becomes immediate for you, you know, it's something that we're all watching on TV. Now, I don't think anybody doubts, you know, the truth in it. But as you said, it's not something, unless it touches you personally, that you see other than experience through your television. Let me ask you some questions. South Korea is being held up as the model in terms of the way they tested. Can you explain to me how were they configured relative to hardware, software, and whatever else needed to be done? You know, differently than the United States is configured, because it seemed like this test thing, our inability to get the throughput we needed because this kind of thing either wasn't anticipated or maybe it was anticipated. And another thing I wanted to talk about with you is, you know, public health, when you do these things, they're not cheap, right? They're big dollars.
No, they're not cheap.
They're big dollars across the country. And maybe you know you want to go there, but maybe nobody wants to fund it. And I can speak to that relative to being on an elected body where somebody comes to you and says, this is the optimum solution. And you look at it and say, yeah, but we just took on the revitalization of 32nd Street, and all our discretionary dollars are there, and we're trying to lower taxes. We'd love to do it. We can't do it. So first thing, the South Korea model, how were they configured so different than we were?
You know, I don't know all of the specifics about South Korea, but I think there are some that are pretty apparent and obvious. One, if you look at size, you know, and size does matter. South Korea is a smaller country. Italy is a smaller country. Italy is the size of Florida. You see how many people there are getting ill. You see in Korea, basically you have a lot of the testing being done in the local hospitals and local areas. In the United States, you know, we have, you know, of course, 50 states. We're a big country, much bigger than South Korea. So a lot of these expensive tests, like for things that we've not seen before, whether it be Ebola or coronavirus, we send to the CDC. The states collect them. If the state labs can do them, they do them. But if not, if it's an exotic test that we've not seen before, we send them to the CDC. Well, that process, collect it, send it, get it there, process it, get it back. You know, that takes time. That could take a week to 2 weeks. You know, my son is in the Air Force. He's been in 18 years. He's in a large Department of Defense laboratory running these coronavirus tests right now down in Dayton, Ohio. And I said, John, how long does it take you to run this test? He says, well, the best we can do is about 4 hours to run one test. Wow. He says, with the latest equipment we have, it's already set up to do that for all three services, but it takes us 4 hours. We're running 24/7. There's only so much we can do. He said, we're trying to get faster machines that people that are available but need to be manufactured so we could do a test in 4 or 5 minutes. So I think that's part of the issue is, do you have the technology? Is it distributed out in a large country like this, or is it a smaller country? You know, and I think South Korea had some advantages, like, you know, a lot of places.
So the way they were configured, both relative to hardware and software, to be able to create that throughput is something that the United States did not invest in. Talk to me about let's talk about money. Grand Forks went through a flood. You know, you mentioned evacuating 50,000 people. And then in the aftermath of the flood, there was, you know, much discussion of all the public health threats from the fuel that got into the water, and all this was in everybody's homes. It had the sentiment that was, you know, stayed there and all of that. So solutions relative to public health, I mean, those are big ticket items.
Those are big ticket items. You know, when we take a look at the flood, it was April 19th, 1997. Kind of hard to forget. We had 13,000 homes in a city of Grand Forks. It's a community of about 60,000 people. We had 13,000 homes underwater. We had 4,000 employees out of work because their businesses were either flooded or the 11 buildings that downtown were burned down. Over 300 businesses were severely impacted. Now, how do you bring them back? Well, I think we were very fortunate that it was an isolated case. By that, I mean people outside of Grand Forks, whether they be churches, whether it be the federal government coming in to help us with money and supplies and loans, could help us get back on our feet. You know, we're a little different here with this disease entity because the entire United States is impacted. And the costs go up, you know, astronomically because of that. And numbers of people go up because of that. And, you know, it's hard to have someone from one part of the country come and help you because you're kind of all in this, even though there are hot spots.
Right. The talk to me about your thoughts on how the country is doing relative to, social distancing, and now forced quarantining, self-quarantine in New York City, well, the state of New York now, and the state of California, and the state of Washington, which are the three states that have been hit the hardest. Give me your thoughts. Have we done okay at this? Have we done good at this? You know, what are your thoughts in terms of, you know, mitigating these kind of pandemics? I'm sure you've sat through Pandemics 101 before. How are we doing?
Well, you know, we can look at some comparisons. You know, you look at China, Wuhan. They basically, China brought in people from all over China, nurses, doctors, in there with equipment to help them out in that province, and quickly, very quickly, at least we think very quickly, got that under control and locked it down. So one is, how quickly do you lock it down so you can spread out the illnesses so that you're able to handle them and bring people in? In the United States, we did cut off, I think it was very smart to cut off travel and monitoring of that travel to China. When we had January, February, March, there were some things we did, I think, that were smart. I think there were some things we were kind of thinking, is it really going to come over here, or is it going to be something that maybe goes somewhere else? And we maybe could have done things a little faster to mitigate what's going on. You know, you can't go back and play Monday morning quarterback all the time, but you would, you know, as a public health official, I would like to have seen a lot of the isolation, a lot of those things happen a lot earlier. But it's awfully tough to tell someone, a business, a politician, hey, you know, we do need to shut down businesses and we need to keep people at home. And they're sitting here going, I don't see people getting ill around me right now. And
Yeah. And now it leads us to, you know, the question of, you know, how long economically can we stay like this? Because and I want to ask you, I want to get your thoughts on that, because to me, what I see is, okay, look, you know, in parts of the country that are either, you know, white, if you look at let's look at a stoplight chart, if you would. So you have California, Washington, New York are red on a stoplight chart. A lot of the rest of the country is yellow, and then there's parts of the country that are green that have, you know, when you talk about incidents per capita, you know, so to me, and give me your thoughts on this, if you're in a green part of the country and you have no underlying physical issues, and you're between the ages of 18 and 59, then you can go back to work and you have to continue to practice social distancing, right? Washing your hands, all the things that we've done in the past, you know, 2 weeks approximately. If you're beyond the age of 60, if you're 60 or older, you're going to have to continue to work from home. Or if you have an underlying, you know, physical condition, you have to work at home too. But if you're in a red state, you're not going anywhere. So I guess my question to you is, how do you come out of this as your thoughts as a public health czar?
Yeah. Well, you know, I do think you have hotspots.
Which you really aren't, but I'm making you one.
Yeah, you know, we're talking about a local, and I'm happy to right. to let you know what I'm reading, because I'm still stay up with that.
Sure.
I still get emails every day from the CDC and look at World Health. But, you know, you look at that one in five people aged 20 to 44 worldwide are coming down with this. So, you know, it's not just affecting the old ones. The old ones come down with it, like myself, you know, age 67, and older ones will come down with it. We may have worse outcomes because we have respiratory conditions, or we're under cancer treatment and our immune system's compromised, or we're diabetic, or, well, all those kinds of things. So people, whether young or old, are going to come down with it. So when I look at the kind of the economics, and when I, you know, recently traveled, as you know, about 10 days ago, last week, back from Florida, you know, I saw a lot of variety of things. One, I saw places in Minneapolis during rush hour come around Interstate 494, five cars during rush hour. They're taking it pretty seriously. Other places, it was like people in bars, people in restaurants. I thought maybe it would just be a drive-through open, which some states had, but some didn't. So as a public health official, I guess what I'm saying is, really, this virus is widely circulating in America. Some places, it's circulating at a higher rate than others because more people have got ill earlier. But it's circulating. We all need to be doing the same thing. We're really not there yet.
there's a lot of stuff that we read, Don, in terms of the malaria treatment and things like that. How, when you read that stuff, you know, how do these things historically tend to be dealt with? Are there things that came to surface, and I'm not up on my MERS or SARS history, but are there things that, you know, what I would call mitigate the thing, and that's what you find initially, and that increases survivability, and then there's at some point a vaccine created for it? How do these things tend to sort themselves out?
I think that's an excellent question. And, I think we got to remember a couple of things. One, these things have happened before. We're going to get through this. Exactly how well we get through this, to how many people have bad outcomes like fatalities or lifetime things they live with, will depend upon what we do now, what we started doing yesterday. That's what we can change and deal with it. When we take a look and say, well, you know, is there a magic bullet? Is there a drug here? Well, they're investigating those kinds of things, whether it's an anti-malaria pill or whatever. But they haven't really found what is effective yet. They're working worldwide, and there are some hopes, but they're working on it. What bothers me is when I read in the paper that a husband and wife in Phoenix were eating pool chemicals because it's a derivative of the malaria drug, and I think one of them died. And they're both in the hospital. And I go, you know, people shouldn't go off on their own and believe that something they read on internet or is something's going to save them. I mean, there aren't any magic bullets yet for this, but we will get through this.
The when you look at Italy, what are the dynamics in Italy that have made it be hit so hard?
You know, I think that's an analysis that we're really going to have to wait for until it's over and get a complete analysis. But you know, I lived in Italy for 3 years, and I can just say there are some things that I see there that are different from what I see here that can make us maybe not quite be like in Italy. What are some of those things? One thing is that their culture very much is one of hugging and kissing, and also multi-generations living in the same household, from the 3-month-old to the 90-year-old grandma who's cooking dinner on a stove, you know. So it's a lot different. We don't see that here in the U.S. We see a lot of people that are more spread out. Our culture here isn't one necessarily of a lot of hugging and kissing and that close contact. So I think there are some cultural differences that might make things less here than there. But the other thing is, how quickly do you put preventions, or how quickly do you try to put something in the way to stop this disease from spreading? You know, how quickly do you put in isolation? How long do you leave it there? How quickly do you develop a vaccine? And those kinds of things. There's some indication that in Milan, which is the financial hub, as you know, of Italy, it's like the New York City of Italy. A lot of the travelers came and went there, especially from China, and they didn't really close down the travel and didn't really sort through that very quickly, and it kind of got out of hand. I'm hoping we have done a better job in the U.S., but, you know, this disease is multiplying in the U.S. It's sad to see 100 more deaths today than yesterday in the U.S., and those numbers are lagging.
And when you say lagging, you mean that there's other people that are infected that indicator is a lagging indicator because it lags by a few days or whatnot, the people that are headed in that direction, eh?
Yeah, it may lag by 2 weeks.
Right.
I do travels. One of the travel agents we use is in Florida, Italian descent, speaks Italian. Three of her relatives have died in a town 20 miles north of Milan. Three of her close relatives have died from this disease, healthy people. One was a elderly grandmother, but the other two were very healthy. So, you know, it's going to affect all of us.
The talk to me about, what do you do at your house? I mean, you just mentioned drove back from Florida here recently. What are the steps? I mean, this has been your business for the majority of your adult life. What are the things that you do to keep yourself safe?
You know, I think there's a lot of things we can do. One is my wife and I have decided, hey, we traveled back. We're going to basically kind of self-isolate ourselves for 2 weeks so that if we did pick up something along the way, might have been on a handle of a gas pump or somewhere else, that we don't bring it back here and pass that along. So we're kind of self-isolating. We feel real good, but we're self-isolating for 14 days here. Secondly, as much as we can do by distancing 6, 7, 8, 10 feet away from people, we're going to do that. We're going to have a virtual coffee with friends this afternoon, and I'm looking forward to that. You know, each of us have coffee, be on the telephone, talk to each other, see how it's going on a speakerphone. Secondly, there's some projects I've been putting off, and I want to kind of do some of my travel books on Shutterfly, you know, do some of those types of things, and do some hobbies, do some reading, catch up on some things that I've put off, catch up with some of my kids, you know, who may be a daughter who's laid off, unemployed now, got laid off last week. I talk to her now 4 times a day. I used to talk to her every 3 or 4 days.
The, you know, that makes sense. Here's an email question for you. Mac, it's good to hear finally somebody who's relatable relative to public health on the program. Thank you very much for having Don on, and much respect for his service in the Air Force. My question is this. Based on what he knows, the availability of testing, what is the hang-up in that? Don, can you explain that? Because we see it like every day. It seems like somebody else is complaining. They said these tests were going to be available, you know, but I can't get one or whatnot. What is the hang up in all that? How does that work?
Well, you know, in public health, let's just take the small state of North Dakota at Grand Forks. We had things in stockpiles, M95 masks, ventilators. Supplies, syringes, you know, to be able to give vaccines out. Because, you know, as you know, a lot of things we have around the country is not made in the United States anymore, made elsewhere, and takes months for them to make it. It takes months for us to get it. So a lot of those things aren't available instantly. So when you have a demand like we've had, there are shortages, and not only shortages of equipment to run it, which we didn't have distributed in America. We're starting to see more hospitals spin up. I see here in North Dakota, in Fargo, hospital said they're going to start running those tests locally here in Fargo this week. And, well, you know, it's taken January, February, March to that happen. I'd like to see that have happened in January. Then you see places in New York say, hey, we're running out of these supplies. How can we get them released from our national inventories and our state inventories? And how can we get some more in the marketplace? I'd like to see more of that stuff made in this country. I think that's part of it. And as you and I had chatted before, a lot of the tests on these exotic type diseases or things we haven't seen, we centralized for cost reasons. And, you know, those were good decisions. You don't have unlimited money, but you centralize them at the CDC. So now we're trying to reverse that and decentralize it. And that just takes time. I think it's important, too, to maybe.
So, Don, let me get this. So what has to happen for me to be able to do the test locally? I have to get a new machine. It might be a hardware solution.
You have to get a machine. You also have to have the right reagents, and you have to have the right test supplies to run through that machine. And you have to have all of that in place before you can run it. And the test kits, I think you may remember in February, that were initially put out by the CDC that was sent to all the state labs.
Yeah.
They had a problem. You know, one component cause an awful lot of false positives, so they couldn't use it. And, you know, we can go back and say, well, why didn't we use the World Health Organization test that was very effective? Why didn't we just use that instead of trying to create one here? I don't know what the politics of that is. All I can say is we were behind the curve in getting the tests out to the states so the state labs can run it. We're behind the power curve to get them out to the local hospitals so they can run it. And if you don't test, you don't know where your pockets are, and you don't know if the person coming in has the regular flu, which in this day and age, I hope I come down with a regular flu and can get Tamiflu and get tested, or do you have something like coronavirus? You have to, as a doctor, be able to differentiate that. Right now, we can't differentiate that very easily or very fast.
Next question. Another email question. Mac, I'm curious. This reservoir of ventilators and respirators. First of all, I'm not sure what the difference is between a ventilator and a respirator. I understand what a mask is, and I have a separate question about that. But my first question is, what exactly is a ventilator? And then what exactly is a respirator? And is there a big reservoir of these, or like most of the other things that we've seen relative to coronavirus, is it manufactured in China, and therefore we are competing with the rest of the world for these assets?
Yeah. Well, I think those are excellent questions. I think let's talk about a ventilator, because we hear a lot about we're short of ventilators. Well, first you say, well, how many do we have? Okay, well, and then how many do we need, right? So if we look at ventilators, let's just pick that first, okay? I know that in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and in with city or county of Grand Forks, we have about 75,000 people. We have 51 ventilators. That's all we have.
What and Don, what is a ventilator?
A ventilator, it does the breathing for you.
Okay, so it's the machine. It's not the mask. Well, that's a component of
it,
I would guess.
You've got to have a mask. You got to have
It's the actual machine.
And the machine that does the breathing for you. A respirator may or may not do the breathing for you. You may even have a manual respirator. But let's just say ventilator. It does the breathing for you. You need that when your lungs have pneumonia in them, and it has. And with pneumonia, there's water in your lungs, and it has trouble getting the oxygen out of the air through that water into your bloodstream.
Right.
And so the ventilator puts pressure on it. It forces that oxygen and also enriches the air. You're breathing a higher percentage of oxygen on a ventilator, and it forces it through that fluid in your lungs into your bloodstream so that you get the oxygen you need. And if without that force, you basically drown. You drown in your own body fluids in your lungs. So let's take a look at the ventilator issue just quickly.
Okay.
Let's just say we have 100 people, okay? And we take a look at the coronavirus. 80% of these 100 people are going to have mild cases. Now, yeah, okay, some of them are presenting with fevers and aches and pains and a dry cough. Some are contagious and don't even have that yet. And some of the young people have some symptoms and maybe some funny symptoms like hearing loss. They may not have had a fever, or they may have a fever, but not now. But let's just say 80% are mild cases, right? 80 out of the 100. 20 out of the 100 or 20% need medical care. I mean, they're not going to get by this episode without medical care. They may have to go to their doctor, and it may be on an outpatient basis, and maybe they can be monitored at home. But 20%, 20 out of that 100 are going to have some sort of at-home, in the clinic or in a hospital, right? Out of that 20% we're talking about, those 20 people, 5% have to be in the hospital. They can't manage at home. They're probably going to have something bad happen to them at home, like a death. So 5% of those out of the 20, which is what? 5% of 20 is one, right?
Okay.
One has to be in a hospital. Out of that one in the hospital, a half a person has to be on a ventilator or they're not going to make it. Okay, that's out of 100. So what did I just tell you? You're going to need one ventilator for every 200 people that have this disease, right?
Right.
You with me so far?
I am.
Okay, so if I have a town say, 50,000 people, let's pick an even number, 50,000 people, and 80% of them have mild, 20% of them need medical care, 5% need hospital, 2.5% need ventilators. That's going to mean that I need, 250 ventilators?
Yep.
And I have 51 in town. Well, I don't want all of those people to come rushing to the hospital because I can't handle it, right?
Right.
If 250 people in Grand Forks run to the hospital, 51 and those 250 have to have a ventilator, they're not going to make it, you basically say 199 are going to die. So you try to flatten that curve, right? That's what we've been talking about. Flatten the curve, spread it out so not all 250 get in there at one time. You want to try to keep that to 51 or as close as you can, because if they're all being used and you, Mac, need to run in the hospital and get one and they're all being used, are they going to unplug somebody or not? They're probably not going to unplug somebody, And we've got all those kinds of permutations.
But well, but hey,
that kind of explains the ventilator issue. And
once they know it, once they know it's me, they're going to unplug somebody. Doc. Come on. It's like, okay, we have McNamara. Come on, get his ass in here. That guy, come
You're
on.
You're not the president.
Exactly. So
that's due to the ventilation issue. And I don't think Grand Forks with the 51 to 50,000 people, I don't think that's far off the mark when you look around the country. You know, I see 44 ventilators in Bismarck. Now, I can't tell you exactly how many L.A. has, but I think the proportion probably in the stockpiles are not too far off from that.
So now all of a sudden we have a situation in that the whole world is running for ventilators. And I don't care who's manufacturing them, the probability that that we're going to get a bunch of them, is low. And even if and much has been written about the president's powers to, wartime powers to convert industry to these needs, that's not going to happen overnight either. We're still talking about weeks before, those manufacturing machines get to those factories, the training that has to be done, the materials get there, and then they do a production run to see if what they're making actually works. I mean, you're talking about, probably months until they can convert that capability.
Well, I hope it's a lot faster than that, and I hope we elongate the number of illnesses until before we get to that point. But it's not just ventilators. I mean, we're talking ventilators as a shortage right now, Mac, but let's ratchet this up. Let's just say that we don't have any problem with ventilators. We can get as many as we want.
Okay.
If there's 250 people that need it in Grand Forks, I can have 250 ventilators. Okay, do I have the nurses? Because you've got to have somebody over that ventilator. Do I have the nurses in town to do that? Well, no. Do I have the supplies in town to do that? Well, no, I don't have all that. So it's more than just a ventilator issue. I mean, you focus on a ventilator, but it's also, are the supplies available locally? You know, are the nurses and professionals that need to monitor these things and put them in and check them, are they there? And we have limits on all of that. So, what you can say is, we can say doom and gloom, there's not enough. Or we can say, yeah, I think we can do our part. We've had bad things happen before. Let's try to do our part and elongate this a little bit so we get more ventilators, but we can also have a staffing that can watch it and we can get the supplies. It's not going to be just a ventilator issue.
Okay. I've got three questions here. Mac, could he go back and explain the difference between a ventilator and a respirator?
You know, I don't work in that area, and I really would – I'm hesitant to say what's the difference.
All right.
Maybe I'll look that up and have to get back to you.
All right.
I hate to say something I don't know.
No, it's a sign of experience. The other part of the first question was, Mac, you don't often say things that are smart, but I heard you say something yesterday about – sanitizing used masks because there seems to be such a need for them. And I was wondering if Don could speak to that. Can we not sanitize some of this PPE that's been used? Question mark.
You know, I think we're going to be forced because of shortages into decisions that in a normal situation we wouldn't want to make. Well, by that, I mean is we're used in America to have an unlimited amount of supplies of stuff. You know, we're fortunate, very fortunate country. They're not as fortunate in Africa where we've seen them reuse needles, okay, and pass diseases from one to the other. In America, we throw a lot of the mask away, one-time use, gone. We do these types of things. I think we're going to have to start making decisions because we're going to have some shortages that we wouldn't necessarily make. And by that, I mean we're going to do the best we can. We're going to use this, M95 mask. When we run out of those, we're going to probably make some masks that maybe can be a barrier. And we're going to do the best we can with that. And we're going to see that as we go through this. For instance, I know that in one lab I'm familiar with, one of the persons have tested positive for coronavirus. Now, the policies are if you get a person test positive for coronavirus, you basically take everybody else that person's worked with and you isolate them for 14 days. Okay, if that lab is doing coronavirus testing and one person, because they went and filled up their car at home or they were exposed to somebody on the street, Do you shut the lab down and now do no testing for 14 days? So what I'm saying is that a lot of the decisions we normally would make with, you know, equipment and reusable and cleaning, we're going to probably go through that. We're going to clean things. We're going to reuse things that probably in a normal day-to-day we don't do. This lab issue where the person came down coronavirus, I know what the decision was. Last week the decision would have been everybody goes home for 14 days and we see how what happens. Well, this week we don't have those people. So the decision was we'll work. Everybody spaces themselves, try to protect themselves. Hopefully you will not come down ill. We'll watch you for 14 days, but we still need you there doing these tests. So that's an example of a not optimum decision, but we have to, you know, we're going to be forced to make some of those with equipment and people, you know, nurses and doctors as we go through this.
I just looked this up. It says a medical ventilator, respirator. Medical ventilators are sometimes colloquially called respirators, a term stemming from commonly used devices. However, in the present-day medical field, the word respirator refers to a protective face mask, and ventilators are never referred to as respirators.
Well, thank you.
And then here's a second one. A ventilator is a machine that breathes for you or helps you breathe.
Yep.
It is also called a breathing machine or a respirator. The ventilator, the breathing tube is placed in the person's mouth or in an opening through the neck into the windpipe. So I don't know that's a couple of different definitions. And to me, I'm not sure that they're not being used by a lot of people interchangeably. So anyway, the next question, here's another one, and you may have answered this before. In Don's experience, how long does it take to make this kind of stuff? I see that as a major stumbling block here. He mentioned a little bit ago in your interview that we should, as a nation, consider bringing some of the production back here into the United States. This stuff doesn't seem to me to be able to be made very easily. Is that valid?
You know, I think there are people around the country that are trying to find out if they have new parts, old parts, other parts where they can assemble machines and help out. But I think you're right. You know, when you talk a brand new machine that's designed, where do most of our parts come from? They come from overseas. And until those places start to put people back to work and ramp up and ship us things, it's going to take a while. So, you know, we're not looking at a solution that's a week or two off.
All right. Here's another question. Mac, I'm curious about the money I'm curious about the money that gets spent on public health. Is it something we do and scrimp on? Now, I know your friend is a professional, so I know he'll be very careful in how he speaks. But a lot of these things are considered Chicken Little events until they happen. And then we wonder why we can't get there quick enough. And the answer is because we didn't really invest in public health because they're low probability events. So I'm curious as to the dollars required and governments around the country, local, state, and federal, unwillingness to spend those dollars on low probability events. Wow, that was kind of complicated. Does that make sense to you, Don?
Well, it does, and you being on the city council probably can answer that. at one time, right?
Well, let
it's
me tell
priorities,
you.
Priorities, right? It's priorities. Right. You know, you try to do the best you can, right, as you're an elected official and try to put the money where it should be. But, you know, if a house is on fire and you've got somebody else saying, hey, but it is on fire, but it's a disease, you haven't seen it yet, you know, are you going to put the fire out or are you going to put the money somewhere else? And so sometimes, you know, those are tough decisions, right? How did you make those when you were on city council?
Well, you had to rank them in terms of priority, and I'll give you an example. We, you know, when I was there, we had a problem with the defined benefit plan, and we assessed that we had to. It was funded at 72%, and we found out that we were probably in the top 15 or 20% around the nation that was funded that high. But we weren't comfortable with that. And so we said, okay, we've got to come up with, I can't remember how many million dollars. Where are we going to get this money? Well, we had to get it from the general fund. So that's got to be a priority, right? We also had, you know, some mill and overlay projects, some street maintenance stuff that was not going to be able to be accounted for in our annual budgeting. So we had to, so there's another priority. And I mean, these streets had been used extensively after the flood, and 32nd Street, I remember, was, you know, a major retail corridor. And, you know, you had to fix it because people are coming to town. It's got heavy use. It's getting bad. And so that's going to take more money. Now, that's your discretionary funding. And then, oh, by the way, you got to give raises to everybody. And you're trying to hold the line on property taxes, which were a big issue. So then Don comes to you and says, okay, we need this kind of hardware and this kind of software and this kind of equipment to the tune of X million dollars. And you're sitting there with all these other things in your head and you say, okay, where does that rank? And it ranks fifth. We can fund three of these things. What are we funding? And so and they're not easy decisions because, you know, Don was, you know, incredibly well respected and he was a straight shooter, but you just can't get there unless you want to raise taxes. And, you know, the consistent refrain relative to raising taxes is, no, don't do it. And so I guess that's a answer to that's an answer to Don's question. It is.
And I give you one more example. During the swine flu epidemic, as we saw that rolling out in February of 2009, as we took a look at that, quickly, Grand Forks said, hey, you know, we don't have the N95 mask here for the hospitals or for our firefighters or policemen. Some of our frontline people are going to be out there. We're going to have to buy some. And if we don't buy it here early in February, it's not going to be available. And so I did go to the city administrator and I said, you know, Rick, I said, you know, we need to buy it. I recommend we buy 25,000 of these before they're not available. Here's the price. And he got together with Mayor Brown, and we went out and bought them, and we were glad we did. They still rotate those through and still have those available, but I don't think everybody does those types of things. I think it'd be good here, too, before we end the program, Mike, to talk a little bit about diseases and targets, because the diseases don't treat everybody the same.
All right. Well, you introduced that. Go ahead and weigh in on that, Doc.
Okay. If we take a look at just historically, the Spanish flu, 1918, 1919, half a million people died in the United States. Half of those deaths were people under age 30. Okay, so Spanish flu targeted young people, right? And then there were some, as you go back and look through history, say, well, there was an outbreak of a flu-like that was similar to that, H1N1, in the late 1800s, and we think some of the older people had some immunity. So, but that was kind of a young target. As I take a look of things like what's happening with this coronavirus, you know, you look around and say, granted, what is going on? And a CDC report last week, March 18th, showed that if you're age 65 to 84, you have a 3 to 11% fatality rate. Bad things are going to happen to 3 to 11% of you. 55 to 64, 1 to 3%. 20 to 54, 1%. We really haven't seen fatalities in people that are very young. Like, we haven't seen cases under age 7 or people, no fatalities under age 19. But 1% still a lot in a population of 300 million, you know, at 20 to 54, we're going to lose a few. So as you do that, that's, you know, you kind of say, who's at risk? So a lot of times when you look at these deaths and you say, well, today we had, I don't know, 43,662 cases in America. That may be understated because of our testing issue, but we had 543 deaths. That's 1.24%. World, when you make that, it's 4.36%. So although you may say, well, there's only a 1% chance in the United States of death, but you look at who this is targeting and you go, well, you know, there are people that need to be taking more precautions than others, and we need to help them. We don't want grandma and grandpa dead. We don't want mom and dad, and none of us want our neighbors that way. So how do we protect ourselves and how do we protect them?
Email question that's kind of tangential to that, Don. Mac, what would Don's advice be were he advising the president on how to come out of this given the way mortality affects people relative to this virus. So what would your advice to him be, Don, if you were in that position?
Well, you know, I would say, well, let's not come out of this too fast. I think opening that floodgate of when you could cause more illnesses and put us right back in the same situation we're trying to prevent. So what I would say is, let's not come out of this too fast. You know, and as I take a look backwards, I say, you know, 2 weeks ago, it wasn't a problem here in America, and then we declared it as an emergency. We really, it's only been an emergency for, what, a week and a half? 2 weeks at best? Not even 2 weeks. Way too early to come out of it would be my opinion and my advice to you.
So slow as pro, if I could use an old first sergeant term that I heard.
That's right. And, you know, we're going to have people that are ill and recover. Those folks we ought to be able to put back to week early. You know, put them back to week first and keep those that are higher risk, you know, let them stay at home. But there ought to be a lot of people that have recovered and have been exposed that we can start opening up the floodgates here. But keep in mind, this is a bell-shaped curve. We are just on the starting edge of this bell-shaped curve in America. And this bell-shaped curve is going to go for 3 months, or 3 or 4 months. So we're looking at March, April, May. Probably come out of it in June, right? July ought to be a good month around the United States. But if we don't do that, we're going to have more problems faster and we won't be able to deal with them.
All right. What haven't I been smart enough to ask you about as you've watched all of this, Don, that you think people should know?
Well, you know, I do get people ask me, said, you know, when we flatten this curve, you know, the bell-shaped curve, when we flatten it, what does that do to the numbers of cases? What does it do to the number of deaths? My answer to them is it doesn't change the number of cases. You know, the number of cases, we're going to come down with this. People are going to get ill over time, and we're all going to come down with this until we get a vaccine and get immunized against it. It'll still circulate, whether it's one wave, two waves, three waves, it's going to circulate. So the number of cases aren't going to go down. We're just trying to spread them out. But by spreading them out, you can reduce the number of deaths because you don't get to a situation like you and I chatted about. We have 51 ventilators. We need 250. How many deaths are you going to have? Hopefully, you have 51 ventilators. You only need, you have 51 people, and you don't lose the other 199.
All right.
So that.
No, Don, first of all, I just want to say thanks for coming on and talking about this, and I hope over the course of the next few weeks or months that you don't mind if I bother you. And as this discussion evolves, really the fate of the nation, the fate of the economy, and the fate of many people changes, if I call you back and ask you to come back on and make us smart again. Because, as you know, I mean, I really enjoy the liberal arts discussion and helping people understand this better so they can make better decisions. And your expertise is much appreciated.
Well, Mike, thank you very much, and I just would love to give you a local perspective and on issues such as this, and especially in my background. But there are an awful lot of smart people in America, and I'm glad they're here.
Let me ask you just about North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota. How are they seeing many cases of this? What is the situation in your neck of the woods?
We haven't seen a lot of cases in North Dakota. That's a testing issue, but also I haven't seen a lot of deaths. So I think it's a little slower getting here. I do see places that are travel hubs, whether it be Minneapolis, Chicago, Tampa, Orlando, New York, you know, L.A. You know, those places seem to be picking up a lot of people quicker because of the traveler issue, the tourism issue, those kinds of things. So, yeah, I do see Minneapolis being a hot spot here locally, and it's spreading.
All right, sir. First of all, welcome home, and give my best to your significant other, and thank you very much again for doing this.
Thank you. Take care.
There you have it. That is Don Shields. He's a friend of mine, former director of public health of the public health department in the city of Grand Forks, in the city and county of Grand Forks. And I'll tell you, when I got on the public health board, I didn't know anything about public health, and I will tell you this. To me, it's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. The education I got, and I don't care if we're talking about water. I don't care if we're talking about infectious disease. I don't care if we're talking about the impact of tobacco on a community. I got a incredible education, and Don always there to educate, to answer questions, and then also to help you, you know, as you tried to make sense of, you know, you told us you need this and it's your number one priority, but we're here financially. Is there any way to bridge this distance between giving you nothing, you know, and trying to give you everything that we can afford? And so you're just a professional. And let me tell you, the work that the Grand Forks Public Health Department did in the wake of you heard him talk a little bit about the flood that happened in 1997. I mean, imagine a flood that affects the majority of the city and that burns down your downtown. You know, just absolutely devastating. And the city, we got told it would take about 10 years, and that was almost absolutely spot on for this city to come back. But the economic carnage that it caused, people are still paying those bills. But they did fantastic work in kind of an unknown situation relative to contaminants and things like that. So just a great guy, and appreciate him coming on this morning. So there you have it. That'll do it on a Tuesday. If you're just joining us, don't touch that dial. Hour one is not the normal hour one. Jeff Kenny and Tim Lynch join me, really at the top of the program. And headlines, you know, yesterday around the media about major changes coming to the Marine Corps, and much consternation among Marines about the changes. Headline in the Wall Street Journal, Marines plan to retool to meet the China threat. The question beyond that is, okay, what about all the other threats that the Marine Corps has to be prepared for too? And so head scratching as the Marine Corps ditches all of its tanks, ditches all of its bridging equipment, ditches artillery, ditches 12,000 Marines, a quarter of which are shooters, are infantrymen. Right? And U.S. Naval Institute News headline, new Marine Corps cuts will slash all tanks, many heavy weapons, as the focus shifts to a lighter littoral force. So does the Marine Corps become the handmaiden coastal battery security for the Navy? Or, right, is this transformational stuff that General Berger sees that makes the Marine Corps a force of choice in the future? So anyway, you'll hear Tim Lynch and Jeff Kenny and I talk about that, kick that stuff around. And so really in something trying to frame, right, frame the debate, right, is this transformational or simply the evolution of the Marine of warfare, okay? And is what General Berger's proposing, is it a modern-day version of the Maginot Line, or is it a modern-day version of the Marine Corps in the early 20th century embracing amphibious warfare, right? Very, very different outcomes with those two things. So we'll talk about some of that stuff. So you'll enjoy it. So don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next. And then tomorrow, I'm not sure if Mark Cancion or TX Hamas is going to join us, but one of those two will be here. And so it'll be an interesting program. So, as we talk about it. So have a great day on Tuesday, All Marine Radio. And again, once again, my thanks to Don Shields, who's a good friend, you know, come on and explain stuff. And here's what I think. I think that as the nation looks to come out of this, I think there's some common sense stuff, you know, that as you look at the data tells you that you can do. And underlying all this is everybody's got to continue practicing social distancing. So you even at meetings, you can't sit next to the, you know, it's every other chair, right? Or every three chairs that somebody can sit in. So not everybody can come to the meeting. Some people are going to have to participate via VTC with the primary players in the room, okay? And those primary players spaced out, okay? So with that being said, you know, people between the ages of 18 and 59 with no other health issues, the mortality rate, right, is very, very low for them. In my opinion, they should be allowed to go back to work. If you have any health complications, you have to stay at home. If you're over the age of 60, you have to stay at home. Okay? And as, because, you know, the, now the next question is, what about restaurants? What about bars? What do we do there? And in my opinion, I don't know that we're there yet. I think that still has to be takeout stuff. I think the hospitality industry is going to be treated a little bit different because they promote large gatherings, right? And we're not there yet. So that one's got to be thought through a little bit more. But I think you can take, you know, I think you can allow the economy to breathe a little bit. So just a thought. Have a great day on a Tuesday, Almarine Radio. Over and out.